dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a great privilege and high pleasure to say that we are joined for this full hour of Secure Freedom Radio by a man who has rendered important service and, well, continuing service in that war for the free world with specific expertise and abilities in regards to what is arguably its single most important battlefront, that of communist China. His name is Brigadier General Robert Spalding, United States Air Force retired. He is these days a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, but he has had a whole host of remarkable prior experiences and responsibilities. He is a PhD in economics and mathematics. He piloted B-52 Stratofortresses. He has been our defense attaché in Beijing, as well as having done some stints in some of the combat theaters of the war for the free world's sort of terrorist components. He is a remarkable national resource, and I'm very pleased to say a personal friend and much admired colleague, and now most recently the author of a very important new book, Stealth War: How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. Rob Spalding, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and congratulations on the new book, Stealth War.
Great to be back. Thank you. And, in addition to the B-52, which was the first airplane I flew, I spent most of my career in the B-2 self-bomber.
Forgive me, that was a little further down in your credentials, and I didn't get quite to it. There's much more to talk about. We'll get into some other things that you've done over the years. But let's start, General, if we could, with sort of a little bit of level setting, if you will. We're dealing today with a dictator for life by the name of Xi Jinping, the president of communist China, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party. But as important as what he's personally about and intends to do is kind of what he regards as the good old days, which tells us a lot about kind of his ambitions for China as well. Could you just take us back to what he thinks of as the heyday of Chinese communism, namely that of Mao Zedong, the founder of the PRC, some 70 years ago, almost to the day?
Yeah, he recently gave a speech where he mentioned the word struggle something like 50 times in the speech. And it's really in reference to what he sees as the awakening of the United States to what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing to America. And he realizes as America wakes up, their ability to tap into our capital, our innovation, our technology, and our talent is going to be severely constrained, which is going to put pressure on the Chinese economy. And so in invoking those words, though, he is invoking probably for the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese people, particularly the ones that were alive during the time, some of the most terrible moments in Chinese history since the Communist Party came to power. And that is during the Cultural Revolution under Mao and also the series of great leaps forward that Mao promised. So one is economic. The Great Leap Forward was meant to be an economic program. And then the Cultural Revolution was meant to essentially obliterate Chinese history and culture and replace it with the history and culture of the Chinese Communist Party. using, you know, the arts, using the academics, using everything, you know, within the society to restructure essentially how people think. And it actually has connections to Confucius. You know, when, if you look in the Analects, with Confucius, when Confucius was asked what would he would do if he became emperor, he says, "I would rectify the names." And so this is something the Communist Party actually does very, very well. And what he means by rectify the names, that is that if you control the things that people say, the words that are used, if you control academia, if you control all the media, and you ensure that a certain way of speaking is used, then you can actually control the way people think. And in fact, the Communist Party has been so successful at this that not only have they gotten their own people to kind of repeat what they say, they've gotten American diplomats to do so as well. So they've actually been quite effective. But to the people of China that live through these horrifying times, when they hear that word struggle said 50 times, they're absolutely terrified that they're returning to, you know, the millions, tens of millions of deaths that were wrought during those two programs.
In the name of the party and, you know, its ambitions to, well, I guess the term here would be fundamentally transform China. So when you hear Xi Jinping using this kind of formulation, tell us, Rob Spalding, about the sort of specific ambitions he has in this moment. It may be, an intensification of the Communist Party's hold inside the country, but it has manifestations far beyond as well, which I guess Mao Zedong could only have dreamt of at the time, but Xi now has it very much in his mind to achieve.
Yeah, it's actually quite simple. There's only really two goals that you can point to for the Chinese Communist Party, and everything is kind of wrapped up in that. One is to maintain control of China and to maintain, you know, ultimate power within China. The Communist Party devotes everything to ensuring they stay on top in China. The second goal, and this is kind of tied to the first, is that they seek to restore China to what they believe it to be is its rightful place in the world. So they look back at Imperial China and seek to create the same kind of conditions where essentially they were the center of the universe, and all other nations essentially looked to them for tribute, protection, and certainly would never cross what the Imperial China, you know, wanted in terms of their acquiescence to.
So the world's dominant power, in short, and this seems, I think, probably for most Americans and probably people throughout what I think of still as the free world to be a ridiculously remote prospect. And yet, I want to go through with you, General Spalding, a number of the things that Xi Jinping is actually doing as part of his China dream to accomplish the supplanting of the United States as the dominant power of the world, and the assertion of China's rightful place, as you say, as the Middle Kingdom. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with General Robert Spalding. He is a retired brigadier general in the United States Air Force, a command pilot with some 27,000 hours in the cockpit of both B-52s and B-2 bombers. He has served, however, in a whole host of other capacities. It's simply impossible to describe all of the things that General Spalding has done in the time we have allotted to also talk to him about his book and the substance of its title, Stealth War, what China has been doing while we've been sleeping. General Spaulding, you've served in senior positions in the Air Force, including as a special assistant to its vice chief of staff. You've also done strategic planning at the National Security Council. These are qualifications in addition to your time in the embassy in Beijing that have, I think, equipped you to give us a very informed description of what it is that we have to worry about with respect to Xi Jinping's efforts to fulfill his so-called China dream. And I'd like to start with what he's described as the Belt and Road Initiative. This is something that is now advancing quite rapidly. Tell us what it is and what it means for China, well, and for the countries involved as well as for us.
Yeah, essentially Belt and Road is a program to link a lot of infrastructure projects around the old Silk Road routes that would see products traded up into Europe and down into China along that route, to also recreate a maritime version of that, much like what the British East India Company was doing when Britain was a dominant power.
Empire building, I think, is a way to describe it, right?
Well, I mean, yes. And you have to understand that, in addition to those two, really what you would think would be vast programs, there's also a 21st century component called the Digital Silk Road. And so that includes not just rail links, not just ports and shipping routes, but also the fiber optic cables that undergird the digital infrastructure of the 21st century.
Notably 5G, as it's called.
Overland cables, you have essentially roughly half the undersea cables now having been installed by Huawei. So essentially, it is an effort to link what China would consider to be tributary states to China in kind of a co-prosperity sphere. And it's probably a poor word to say co-prosperity, because it's really a Chinese prosperity sphere, whereby they can actually take advantage of the peoples of these economies to gain wealth and prestige for the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, and of course, that's a term redolent of the empire building of Japan back before World War II. And it, too, was, I think, a more or less one-way street for the Japanese. Rob Spaulding, one of the features of this Belt and Road build-out, as you say, is obtaining infrastructure to which the Chinese will have some access, at the very least, if not as a result of something called debt traps, actually acquiring ownership of many of these assets, including some of which are very much designed or have at least the ability to become available to Chinese military forces, whether those are long-range aircraft like used to fly in the Air Force or naval forces of various kinds, or the Huawei build-out for intelligence and other purposes. Could you just give us a sense, as you see it, as a strategist, of the value to Communist China from the perspective of a state that wishes to dominate the world as the means by which it can project power, it can control strategic choke points, and it otherwise can, no kidding, have a dominant position globally?
Well, I think the key benefit is that if you go back to Commodore Perry's trip to Japan, in order to actually open up a society for trade prior to the era of globalization, you actually had to threaten military force. What China is able to do by essentially making deals with these sovereign nations to acquire their assets by essentially pulling the wool over their eyes and creating these usurious loan terms, that they can acquire territory that they need to establish footholds in these countries without firing a shot. And so what that allows them to do is actually fund their military at a really low level up until the time when they have essentially created the global structure, infrastructure they need to actually support a global force. So It's actually quite ingenious strategy if you think about it, because, you know, rather than needing to have a very powerful military, they can just on the basis of globalization and the internet, take advantage of the openness of the free world to essentially insinuate themselves everywhere. So it really is a way to turn openness as a strength of democracies into an incredible vulnerability for democracies.
Yeah. On the cheap for China, and essentially with these kind of payday loan sorts of schemes, they secure a position from which they can essentially extort these countries. I guess there's some corrupt officials that get paid off in the process in many cases too. But by and large, the people of the countries in question suffer terribly, notably because they don't, by and large, have employment opportunities as a result of the construction or the operation of these infrastructure elements. Is that right, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a classic business model that the Chinese Communist Party pursues, is to essentially line the pockets of elites in the countries in which they operate, provide jobs for their own people, and ensure that the people of the countries within which they're operating don't have jobs. And so, remember, as I said, you know, goal one was linked tightly to goal two. If you can use the economies of your adversaries to provide consistent economic growth and jobs to your own people, then your legitimacy to rule is essentially supported. And so they use this parasitic nature of what they're doing with other economies to cement their own rule by showing the Chinese people that, hey, you know, we are being successful in providing you jobs. And of course, to the average Chinese, if they can have a job, if they can have a home, if they can send their kids to school, if they can essentially live what used to be the American dream, then they're more than happy to forego freedom of speech, freedom of religion, really freedom from oppression. They're really more than happy to go along, to get along, because, you know, at the end of the day, all they want to do is raise their families in peace. And so it's only when, you know, that behavior becomes exposed and the democracies of the world begin to protect themselves that the economy, the economic growth that's supporting the Chinese Communist Party begins to slow. And then the Chinese people will wake up out of their slumber and they'll say, okay, we forfeit, you know, basically our rights to be humans, because you were giving us, you were promising us, you were delivering on a promise to continue this economic growth, and now you can no longer do it because your scheme has been exposed.
Yeah. And there's some sense that Xi's overplayed his hand and made that exposure rather more obvious prematurely, and we'll come to that in the next block. Rob, I want to talk with you about how America's, well, elites, I guess, but more to the point, how America's population, and most especially its president, had begun responding to this overexposure of Xi's plans. But before we get there, just we have a couple more minutes in this block, and I did want to just ask you a quick question. In addition to the Belt and Road Initiative, in addition to the terrestrial build-out of empire, there are a number of things that the Chinese Communist Party is up to that are also playing a synergistic role, it would seem, with respect to that that ambitious plan, both at sea, in places like the South China Sea, and in space, undersea, deep undersea, for that matter, in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. And I just would ask you, just in the shortest of short forms, how does all that fit into this master design of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party?
Well, one of the things that the Chinese Communist Party needs are resources. They need raw materials for their manufacturing. They need energy. They need food for their people. And so all of these are related to exactly what you're talking about. They just recently, I believe, offered a deal to to the Philippines saying, hey, we'll take all the resources of your exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. We'll take 60% of what's in there, and you can get 40%, because essentially we consider all these waters of the first island chain to be essentially Chinese national waters. And so it is to take the resources that they need. Now, if you look at that, you know, their chief challenge for getting resources is acquisition of U.S. dollars, because most resources today are bought and paid for in U.S. dollars. And so if they can create a situation where they don't have to pay U.S. dollars to get resources, because they actually control and own and control those resources outright, so they can use their own people and equipment to extract those resources. And that's what they're going to try to do, because they can pay their own people renminbi. So it's actually, you know, this need for U.S. dollars to support the Belt and Road Initiative, to support Made in China 2025, to support really the growth of their economy, requires that they create these unfair situations where they're taking territory to use the resources, so they don't actually have to have dollars to buy them on the open market.
Russ Folding, we have to take a quick pause. We will be right back with the author of Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Brigadier General Robert Spalding, United States Air Force retired. He has, as I have indicated, served his country with great distinction in the uniform of the Air Force, but also has continued to do so now that he's taken that uniform off. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and he is now the author of a brand new and terrific book, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. And Rob, I want to turn to that now. Of course, the relationship between the United States and Communist China really began, in any sense other than adversarial, dating back, of course, most especially to the Korean War, in the 1970s, when Richard Nixon decided that he would open up a second front, I guess you might say, against the Soviet Union by having normalized relations with Communist China. You've studied all this closely. You've lived in Beijing. You speak Mandarin. You are one of the country's real duty experts on what China has been and what we have done, as you say in your subtitle, sleeping. Our elites sleeping through much of what has flowed from Nixon's opening. Give us a quick course on how that worked out, specifically the policy of engagement that flowed from Nixon's opening.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look across the vital institutions of the United States, whether they be political, whether they be academic, whether they be corporate, whether they be financial or think tanks, law firms, PR firms, media, essentially, the Chinese Communist Party has used its largesse to court them in an embrace whereby the Chinese Communist Party has been quite successful at convincing them that, in fact, China is, in fact, is a democracy, and except that their democracy is just a little bit different from the West, and that they take FDR's four freedoms, essentially trash three of the freedoms, and really design their democracy the way that they define it around freedom from want, or, you know, essentially delivering economic freedom to the Chinese people.
So no freedom of speech, no freedom of religion, you know, what freedom of association was it? What was the third?
Freedom from fear was the third, and freedom from fear is really freedom from oppression. And so the right for the Chinese Communist Party to oppress you anytime it feels necessary is sacrosanct in China. And they use the Ministry of State Security and the People's Armed Police to enforce that and to get to essentially maintain their writ within China. But our elites have essentially been, you know, on the political side, afforded junkets, so full paid trips into China, where essentially they put on a show for these people, showing them happy, smiling Chinese people and how, you know, China is really a democracy of the 21st century. Same with media journalists, you know, movie producers, actors, actresses, you know, the entire, you know, hedge fund managers, investment bank leaders, corporate leaders. You know, in fact, when Deng Xiaoping came to the United States during reform and opening, he did go to the White House, but he spent most of his time in Texas and Seattle. So in Detroit, I believe. So look, you know, talking to the leaders of industry, auto manufacturers, Boeing, and I believe oil companies in Texas. So he was courting the West and trying to convince them that China could be a wonderful partner for the American people. Now, of course, when they were talking about being a wonderful partner for the American people, it was really about enriching the owners of capital and cementing the political leaders and really the institutions around what the Chinese Communist Party wanted to do. And in essence, it was to hollow out the economic capacity of the country, leaving what are the blue collar class of the country behind, as essentially all of their employment was shifted over to China.
Right. And so was much of their technology, including complete manufacturing plants, simply lock, stock, and barrel were taken off to begin doing the same sort of thing they had been doing in this country over in the People's Republic. We had a terrific program of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, as I think you know, Rob Spalding, a couple of months ago in Chicago. And we heard firsthand from some of those American, many of the Indian American manufacturers about how China did exactly what you've just described, hollowed them out, destroyed their manufacturing capacity with various trade techniques and predatory, you know, business practices. And lo and behold, we're buying most of what we need in this regard from China now. And that's a national security problem of the first order. And it didn't seem to trouble our elites. And I did want to ask you about one specific piece of this. You mentioned the kind of assiduous influence operations that the Chinese waged against our elites. Just recently, there was a columnist in the Washington Post who talked about something he called a white list. Tell us what that is and how that operates to influence our perceptions of what the Chinese are up to.
Well, you know, yes, they advertise having a white list, but in reality, they've had a list. You know, that's just exactly how the Communist Party operates. In other words, in particular, if you're considered to be a Chinese expert in the United States, one of the things that you need to do is spend a lot of time in China. That's considered to be one of your bona fides as a China expert. And so the way that China modulates whether or not you can be a Chinese expert is they don't grant you a visa. And so the way that works is if you speak out against the Chinese Communist Party in any way, then your chances of getting a visa are basically relatively zero.
You're on the blacklist, in other words, as opposed to the whitelist.
That's exactly right. And privately, I would, you know, you can go and talk to many of our, you do this test. The Epoch Times is one news media organization that's violently anti-communist. And frequently, they'll go to these Chinese scholars in the U.S. and say, hey, will you willingly come on Epoch Times to talk about China? And they refuse. And they know that if they do, that the Chinese Communist Party will deny any visa for them to come into the country. And this occurs quite frequently. So it's a powerful mechanism for controlling the narrative on China in the United States, because most people look to Chinese experts for what the Chinese are doing. And the Chinese experts are essentially, because of this behavior, in the pockets of the Chinese Communist Party. And so when people say China in the United States, they're actually meaning the Chinese Communist Party without actually understanding that.
Right. And we won't have time to do justice to this topic, I'm afraid, Rob Spalding, but another way in which this is affected, this influence operation and how we perceive China and what we say or do or even think about it is through Confucius Institutes operating in our academic institutions, which are essentially defining who does the teaching, what they use in the way of curriculum to the next generation of China experts who also are going to want to get into communist China, of course. But Rob, before we run out of time in this block, I did want to just ask you, so we've had these kinds of influences in the business sector, in academia, in the culture, and for that matter, in government, embracing and pursuing assiduously what has come to be called the engagement policy with China, which has meant essentially opening ourselves up to, you know, this kind of rape of our industrial sector and so much more. You served at the beginning of the Trump administration in the National Security Council and were responsible for strategy. I think you had a significant role in defining the national security strategy and, for that matter, the national defense strategy of President Trump's first term. Give us a sense of the differences between the Trump approach. It's obvious, of course, with respect to trade, but more broadly, between those that have pursued this engagement policy on the other side.
Yeah, I think the best way to explain Trump's unique national security policy and foreign policy strategy is to compare it to the Eisenhower administration. So one of the things that the Eisenhower, President Eisenhower said, beware the undue influence of the military-industrial complex. And if you look at what we've done in terms of since the end of the Cold War, how we've defined national security policy, it's been quite militaristic in terms of, you know, interventionism just about everywhere. And I think what the president is trying to redefine is, again, much more in line with Eisenhower, which was have your military as a very potent force that adversaries look at as a risk and don't and decide not to essentially compete with, and then grow the economic strength of the country, grow the industrial base, reinvest in infrastructure. We're $5 trillion in arrears. Invest in STEM education and research and development. You know, research and development, we're down to 0.7% of GDP, and most of that's in health. So we're not doing the kind of basic science research that we were doing in the Cold War. So, you know, in Eisenhower's term, he did a project called Solarium, where they essentially looked at, you know, the long telegram.
Rob, this is such an important point. I don't want to cut you short, but we have to cut you short for just a moment. We'll be right back with the author of Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, Brigadier General Robert Spalding, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're speaking with a highly qualified expert on national security in general, but also especially on the threat to our national security posed by the Communist Chinese Party of Xi Jinping. And I wanted, Rob, to wrap up what you were just getting at, which is, you know, how the Trump strategy has differed from the engagement approach. Specifically, we've, of course, seen this showcased in the area of trade, but it also is happening, or has to really happen, with respect to a number of other things. And I just would throw them out and put them on the table and ask you to sort of walk through them as you can in terms of your recommendations for what we need to be doing now. We're watching Hong Kong literally on fire. We're seeing increasing threats from communist China, not only to the people of Hong Kong, but also to the people of Taiwan and to the people of the United States, notably through the advent of hypersonic missile technologies, among other things, and also a growing capacity to weaponize and operate against terrestrial tech activities and targets from space. And not least, you know, what they're doing in the economic sphere in terms of our currency and borrowing or securing investment money from us. These are all parts of the battle space with China. And I'd like to have you sort of give us a sense of what is Donald Trump doing with respect to these various elements, and what should the United States be doing going forward?
Yes, and I think it's important to note that a lot of the work that went into the national security strategy actually was done prior to the Trump administration. So it was actually done in the Pentagon. My shop working on China for the chairman was actually looking at strategic competition with China and really kind of built the template that we used to build the national security strategy in the first year of the Trump administration.
Yeah, but the work was done. But we need to say, Rob Spalding, that it was not the policy of the Obama administration.
It was built in anticipation of an administration that would be willing to actually confront the challenges that we face using a clear-eyed vision for what the future held if we did not change. And what we found during that study is that we weren't in a military competition with a rising China. We were actually in economic competition, and that the Chinese had maneuvered us into a position very similar to what we had maneuvered the Soviet Union into. And so we were headed towards bankruptcy. And so the pillars of the national security strategy are really about realigning free trade principles and democratic principles. So rather than just globalization without the principles in the Atlantic Charter, we were going to very vociferously retie our free trade with democracies that actually essentially accepted our same principles for an international order. So retying trade and investment and immigration and media and politics with those democracies that thought the way we did about how society should be organized, and then decouple ourselves from those totalitarian regimes that did not. In doing so, we were going to protect along finance, trade, investment, media, politics, the internet, academia, those institutions of the West that were actually strengths of the West in creating innovation, technology, and talent, and then providing capital into those to create economic growth. And then the third pillar was really about reinvesting in America. It was about investing in the industrial base, returning that over 70,000 factories that had been systematically dismantled and shipped to China, and creating the ability to manufacture the things that protect ourselves, in addition to the $5 trillion in arrears and infrastructure, educating the new scientists of the future. You know, we educate a lot of our scientists during the space race of the Cold War, and investing in basic science research. And once we had that, we believed that the economy and the technological prowess of the United States and its allies would grow. And as that happened, we would be able to assert more democratic principles in multilateral institutions like the UN and WTO. So it's really forging a new consensus, like the Western consensus, but based on a whole bunch of new democracies that have sprung up since the end of the Cold War. And, you know, because today the Western consensus is essentially dead, as we no longer can achieve democratic outcomes in a geopolitical sense. Now, when in response to your question about the military portion of the strategy, it's actually looking quite clearly at what China has done in terms of, you know, creating this technology and economic mismatch between their force mix and the United States. And so one of the challenges that we have is that the United States, from a national security perspective today, is aligned around a unipolar vision of the world. In other words, the United States is a supreme power. And so we have all of these geographical combatant commands that request resources from the Department of Defense. And quite frankly, we could never source all of those because the challenges in each of the regions, whether they be Russia for Europe or Iran for the Middle East or North Korea for Asia, really makes it almost impossible for these combatant commanders to fully resource what they need to do to stand up against those threats. So we need to lean on our allies to do more there, but we also need to think about the force mix. So in the European theater, the Russians have really taken a page out of Eisenhower's book, and instead of pouring massive amounts of money into conventional power, they've essentially rebuilt their nuclear prowess. And so the United States is on a path to reinvigorate the nuclear triad, and I think that's extremely important. But at the same time, we're trying to build two extra aircraft carrier battle groups, you know, thousands of F-35s. You know, the Army wants to maintain, essentially a 500,000 man force. And the Marines are, again, trying to re-equip. So what we are spending is $800 billion on a military machine that, quite frankly, is driving us into bankruptcy because we're not actually investing in the country anymore. So we need to actually shift some of those resources into growing the industrial base, growing the country, growing the technological prowess. In the Pacific theater, instead of the nuclear plan that the Russians have carried out, the Chinese have carried out a ballistic missile plan. So ballistic missiles are incredibly cheap. And in fact, they require us to spend 30 times what the Chinese does on military in order to project power in the region. And so the Chinese, in creating these ballistic missiles, because in the United States not being able to respond because we are in an INF treaty, an intermediate nuclear forces treaty with Russia that they were actually violating, prevented us from investing smartly in the Indo-Pacific region. And so now that we're out of the INF treaty, we should basically take a lot of the money that we're spending on kind of forces that were made to fight in the Middle East and Europe and reallocate those that money into intermediate range ballistic and cruise missiles launched from ground, air, and sea platforms. You know, as we do that, we begin to create the kind of deterrence that, you know, Eisenhower was looking for when we were in competition with the Soviet Union. If you look at how that came about, there's actually a mathematician who was in the Air Force figured out, based on, you know, ICBM throw weight and the cost it would cost the United States to protect the American people from ballistic missiles using a defense shield, that in actuality it would cost us six times as much for every dollar that the Soviets added to their offensive capability. So that's where mutually assured destruction came from, a realization that if we try to defend ourselves using a ballistic missile shield, that the Soviet Union could easily outspend us, and we would essentially bankrupt ourselves. So Eisenhower is very focused on the economic strength and vitality of the nation as an engine for protecting us and basically sustaining us in a long-term competition. So what they did then is, instead of spending, you know, enormous amounts of money to meet the conventional force in the fold the gap in Europe, we turned around and we built the Eisenhower National Highway System, which has sustained our economy since the end of the Cold War and now is crumbling. So not only do we need to rebuild that, but we actually need to build the digital highway of the future and create a secure and encrypted 5G network for America that will sustain us into the technological competition of the future.
Rob Spalding, you've laid out a grand vision of what we need to be doing in the face of this multifaceted and dynamic and unfortunately intensifying threat from communist China. There's so much more to talk with you about, sir. I appreciate your time today. I hope you will come back to us for a much longer conversation soon. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.